Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects. It's good to have you sitting in with us again this day. Each day, somewhere, there is a person discovering more about Masonry and becoming intrigued, if not for their own with their own specific kinds of questions, then certainly with the context. When you think about the way that we position Masonry, we know and understand hundreds of years of history come with it, and it in itself brings a legitimacy to it. I'm not saying that everybody walks around feeling this angst, feeling the need to be validated. I'm not saying that. That may happen, but I don't think that's necessarily something that goes through. Runs through a person's thought all the time, just like any other thought. You move on. It's a lot of these things, because our minds are so amazingly dexterous, we can move through these ideas very rapidly. It's not to say that we all have ADHD, or we don't all experience, you know, that magpie syndrome, where the next shiny thing is going to capture our attention. Now, some people are more inclined to that than others. But if we're sifting through all of us and looking at the kind of character, the kind of traits that seem to congregate in certain types of personalities, drawn to certain kinds of professions or certain kinds of tasks or journeys, we begin to notice patterns, we begin to notice similarities. It's not to say that we have this determinist sense of absolutism. We don't have absolute knowledge of very, very much, if anything at all. Our statements are more, I don't know if they're less meaty, have less weight. We accept by embracing the need and respecting morality, we accept that we will never totally and firmly and absolutely know things. Morality helps us to understand that different circumstances, different times and ingredients, different situations require capacity to calculate the ethical choice. In other words, what I decide in one situation today may not be at all appropriate tomorrow. And yet, when you say that, you think that, we can begin to realize there are some things that are almost absolute in our thinking, almost. And then if we're pressed, if we're so full of that kind of a notion, we may miss the learning that a philosophical proposition opens up. Because there's always, there's these contradictions. If you scratch the surface a little bit about philosophy, there's contradictions about just about any kind of a premise. There's the contradiction about truth, all Cretans are liars kind of thing. And what it does, changes, it exercises our thinking. And in some ways, masonry does that too. It takes us to a threshold and it presents us with a number of choices along the way. And during our first journey, our guide answers, the questions are put to us by others who are saying, which direction are you going in? And so somebody speaks on our behalf as if they have our best interest and best nature in heart. And not only that, but by virtue of a recognition of human patterns, they are able to describe them. And often, would it be fair to say often, the things that we hear described about ourselves, we've never thought, or we've vaguely thought, but who would be so arrogant to say those things out loud? And I am an honorable man. Well, if you walk around with that kind of a notion, you're going to be losing a lot of friends. But no need to be banging a drum. Along the way, we're also taught subtlety. Well, teaching us that doesn't mean we're going to use it. It means we know it. It doesn't mean we necessarily understand it or that we apply it. The different, just the simple calmness. So finding that what centers you, my goodness, if you're at a loss, it's a good starting point. It's the excitement of starting out. What you know your history intimately, you know variations on it. You have your own opinions about your history, and oftentimes by having an opportunity to have dialogue about your own history, more emerges. Unfairly ask somebody who's very rigid to say, which is right? Well, they're both right. But they may contradict. Well, yeah, but they're both, in the strictest sense, both right. So as you find that point of what does it? We know, we're not choir boys. We know that some men, for whatever reason, find that having a drink, finding that it relaxes them, it excites them, it seems to free their thinking, and they wouldn't be alone in that notion. We'd be Greek generals. Knew that. Droman certainly did. They used that strategically with their generals. One just said, one night would be set aside for quite a party, and everybody would sit down and drink heavily, and the serious questions of battle would be put, and scribes would record them, record all the answers, and then shortly after, the same opportunity, but with sober thought, no intoxicants of any sort, and the serious questions were again put to the crowd, to the room, and the answers were written. And then the overseers would sit down and analyze and compare, and where those two conversations matched, that was something that was taken more seriously. those were considered more valid. It's an interesting kind of a way to test and validate ourselves in our own thoughts. There is a maturity, and I think ultimately it's not something. It's like you tune in here, my goodness, how much thoughtful conversation do you want? Well, some people don't find it at all a struggle. Others, particularly people with their own individual struggle, are almost lost in it. Anyway, we're going to start the show today. And I'll just assume that you're going to be part of the you're going to be part of the crowd of people with questions on your mind, perhaps finding that point of calmness where you're centered and able to weigh your priorities and learn from what's going on or be reinforced. It's a good day to be a Mason today, and we have some interesting patterns unfolding around us, and it's an incredible opportunity. Ha! Here, speaking of incredible opportunity, Keith Jarrett. Thank you. Don't you love a jazz pianist that just gets into the groove and sings along with his own music? It's just so personal, isn't it? He shares that with us. Ha! Where to go with this? It happened that that I've been dealing with thinking and attempting to assist other people to learn the ways of masonry, to learn that masonry is an applied science. You know, we have theory and we have a practice, and we also have this sort of these moral junctures that we deal with, but we attempt, because we know that would be burdensome for normal people, not for zealots and not for people that are very, very, very dedicated, but the majority of us have other dedications, and we're looking not to make this the supreme dedication, but to make it part of the balance of our life. And that's what we simply strive for, is that to achieve some sense of balance, hopefully. But making it, how to apply? Well, I can't really tell you how to do that. Nobody can. That requires a field of judgment that comes to you in your daily duties, the priorities and the tasks of daily living that you have, how you apply it. It's like starting off your day with a thought. If you haven't done this, it sounds quite far fetched. That you can influence the tone of your daily movements through the acquisition of an idea that it's possible. And if you think it's possible, then you're not sure, then test it and try it. And you have the testimony of other people, of course, but it really depends on you and your conviction. To have a day and you think about this in a more enlightened kind of a sense, if you and I agree that it takes two people to have a fight, then if you're not one of them, if you simply say, no, it doesn't, whatever comes before me, I will not allow conflict to take over my thinking. And then there is no fight. And without you overpowering anybody or being more articulate than anybody by your behavior, your manner, whatever it is, whether it's the words you say or the words you don't say or the timing. You, in that sense, are controlling or influencing an outcome for your own betterment, huh? And for the betterment, who needs, is there somebody that needs to rehearse a grown man making fool of himself by displaying a temper? Well, my goodness, we all know it's an old ploy to cover up weak ideas, or we know that, but it's embarrassing when somebody that claims to be a friend would have to do that. Because it makes them look, one hand quite foolish, and it's quite inauthentic. And what are they going to do? They expect that their person is, anybody around them is in opposition, and they need to be in some way dominated. Come on, that's hardly a mature way of going about life. Just. Because somebody has a chip on their shoulder, as they say, we absolutely control them. We walk away, turn our back. Somebody can proselytize all they can, but it's interesting seeing that earnestness. If you see it for what it is, that the weakness of the argument has to be compensated with this. This sense that having a temper tantrum is going to in any way enhance what their person is saying. It fits with the commentary today, and I think I hope you'll agree. And I titled this one "Irrelevance in Rhetoric," and I'd like to think that all of you, each listener out there, has an opportunity to practice, to learn about rhetoric, and to have an opportunity to practice it, because it is very, very helpful. It's a very interesting skill, and it's one of our, I think, underrated liberal arts in terms of popularity. Think of it more as having tremendous utility, and all of the subtlety that a gentleman could want. Humanity is well past the time we can claim naive are and will always be dissenting opinions, just as there will be confusion when opinions of no account are transmutated into truths. Gee, I wonder what was on my mind. It's just the media is full of these examples. It is risky to reveal, but unavoidable. Masonry offers itself up as a formula or a process to enlightenment or the ethics of an ethical life, of understanding truths. We don't ask for Shaolin commitment. We don't. Be yourself. But we know that you're striving. You're audacious, upstart. You're trying to round that out so that you can be more of a complete human being. Well, yeah. In our eyes, you're not. We ask only that a man declare and assume oaths and responsibility to commit. You know, it's like, are you interested? If you show up to a ball field with your baseball glove, we're all going to assume you'd like to play baseball with us. Or if you show up at the pitch with a football, we're all going to assume, right, mate, there you go. Let's see what you're good at, what's your sense of perspective and how you read the field. Let's see. You do that, but more so at this level, and we want to know: are you serious about this? Well, we're asking you to commit and say you're serious about something you don't really know yet. You haven't really tasted the fullness of it, have you? So. All we know is when you say yes, that you're eager to learn. You're eager to learn what that is. And then it becomes self-directing very, very, in a very serious way. Are you able to be that self-directed learner? Well, that's a little bit of a shift. We, on one hand, have the obligatory things that we need to exchange and need to chew so that we recognize you, silly. And the gravitas, the seriousness, well, you're not known. You've not been in a lodge before. And you'll hear these terms that are unusual, the sanctum sanctorum. Well, it's upon us to show you what that atmosphere feels like. And that life isn't a joke, and that there is a point to demonstrating respect with knowing what it is you're respecting. That's the forms of greetings, the things that we don't say. Although I've seen some fools walked into a coffee shop one day. And some fool was flashing me the sign. And it's like, hey, you know, what do? Do you shake your head? Do you go about? I went about just ordering my cup of coffee as if nothing was happening. So here's a guy making this odd gesture. And that was all I could do. What do you say about that? There's no words, but it happens. We expect that there's some commitment from you to learn these things, and to learn and accept the discipline that goes along with it. There is a discipline in the backstory of this, but you do that for yourself. That it requires a desire and will that can't be imposed. It requires that completeness or happiness that you're working on something because it's important to you. Because nobody can make you do that. The truth of it is, nobody can force you to practice and put in the hours. Nobody can do that. They can make you feel guilty about it. We see that with, you know, poor parenting. But this is, you don't, what, you're a grown man. You're not going to, you're expecting some kind of paternalism here? Come on now. You know better. The putting in the practice because you're reinforced, because you're encouraged that nobody was praising you because, you know, even little kids realize what flattery is. It's like, what do you want? It's manipulation. Eh? So, here, it's encouragement, real-world validation. This is what you're doing really well. If you're interested, I can give you some feedback on some other things that I see. Well, if a child or a person is smart and they have that capacity and they are intuitive and intelligent enough to know that they need the mentor in order to take them further than they can themselves, that crossroads, that decision you make by yourself, of course, because nobody else can do that. Have you not? Where I am, I'm in a jurisdiction where nobody's making me, therefore I don't have to. Yeah, it's, what would you say, arrested development? But it's facing the consequences of that. The consequences are, you know, less than wonderful. We do move forward, but one person, one step at a time. When you come to these realizations, it's grim when I see somebody wrestling. They have other priorities and this doesn't fit. Well, yep, that's absolutely right if you think that way. I tend to think that we've missed a lesson with that person, or if we have taught the lesson, that the person has made this, you know, this conscious effort, a deliberate effort, the lesson being balance. How do you, very, very little in life happens to us when we want it and when we need it. Usually the fates are on us. We can be as determinist as we would like, but to deny the yin of life, or what? To deny the physics that are around us, that sense that even with a compass point, some people would have us believe that one of those compass points north. Well, if I'm in Australia, what's north? It's relative. We need to be able to understand these things so that we are able to make consistent and positive judgments and be able to live with the results. And hopefully, we have hope that we're getting a little better, a little more understanding. And we don't need to do it at the expense of any other living creature. We don't need to. We can finally get over this sense of ego that we need to be able to dominate somebody or something in order to feel whole or complete, or that we need to compensate that, somehow in the incompletion in our own mind, that subconscious sense of incompletion, we need to be able to control our environment. Unleash the OCDs on the world. But we temper it. When you understand it, you temper it. Oh, OCD, my goodness. Exceptionally valuable in certain careers and certain tasks. Exceptionally necessary. So you're going to try and erase this? What kind of foolishness is that? Before you're so awkward about it, make an effort to listen to the experts. No, because the secret is your opinion may not be the expert opinion. We ask only that a man declare and assume oaths and responsibilities to commit. We don't ask a lot, do we? But it's like, look at what, by the way, that's before we open the door here. And you're ready to commit? Well, yeah. This isn't you banging a drum. This is you and that over there, that goal, and that's a symphony orchestra. And you're going to come in as what? The solo performer? Oh, you are. First, you need to learn how to play an instrument. Individualism with limits is a path going nowhere. Let's see what we're capable of doing. And in the meantime, color between the lines. Here's Paul Desmond to help us along with this idea. Yeah, feeling blue. Thank you. Did you have a palate cleansing there, Paul Desmond? Yeah, I know. They're short. They're not the entree. They're more like aperitifs. I apologize for that. It's beautiful music, and to end it, so that we can put together this program. I only hope that it'll put a music worm in your ear that you'll need to go back and follow. So sit back, top up your brandy glass or your cup of tea or tisson, and let me regale you with the notions of somebody that was hanging around not so long ago with W.H. Auden, that crowd, that bunch of the Oxford University types. And as much as we can say that the toffs, the people that lose their sense of self-respect and replace it with this, the ugliness of entitlement, these are people that, in spite of that, seem to have had a square head on their shoulders. W.H. Auden, we know about. We've touched on his work at different times. People, when you're in a college, you learn about each other. C. Day Lewis and Stephen Spender. We had one of Stephen's poems last week. It's called The Truly Great. This is a guy, Lewis, who was part of that group too. Very low-keyed, unpoetic, socially committed. He was writing what was called new poetry, and this was coming out in the 1930s. So I think, in some way, for me, it appeals because it's in the aftermath of World War I, the war to end all war, and that brief period of great hope. The horror is over. But the price, it was worth it, because we were going to end all war forever, all men. And we dropped the ball when we had to talk about reparation, because the war was not over. It just changed the tools of war, the equipment of war changed. And it led to that, and it was more than an assassination that was percolating in the 30s. We had psychosis took over, and the risk was boiling. There were concerns on one side, and people, the optimists, saying, no, that's you're overstating the threat. And so the threat was overstated, and the triggers were kept locked until it broke out. Today, we're using that as a model, unfortunately, and perhaps not so ready to turn a blind eye to the utter chaos that is likely, but is potentially there. These guys were understated. Well, of course, what the hell is going on, huh? And today, what do we do? we run down the street with our hair on fire? No, we don't. We watch, we listen, we try to stay well informed, but not to embellish it. We hear voices, people that have been silenced, struggling to be identified. And we're hard pressed. What do we do with these things? If we take them seriously, do we take them seriously? And is there room? Well, we know that power doesn't really like to shift, and certainly doesn't like to be shared. And yet we have these very vibrant notions of accountability around us. And lastly, we have this symbiosis between the internet and these bloody smartphones. You want accountability? Just buy a smartphone. Just buy a phone. You can take a picture. You can record everything that's going on. We have record of it. And it's coming back on us. Do I actually sound like that? Is this the person that I've supported? I did not know this about her or him. And now we do, and it's daunting. What do we do with that information? Well, my trust is that we're going to reveal the complication of a lack of ethics. Will the world, in its wisdom, turn to the ancient cultures and their ethics? One can only hope. And when we line those up, where are those lessons? Well, what do we have? Lithuania, the old kingdom. But predating that, what do we have? China? Of course, we would probably begin with looking there. Greece? Yes. And Rome? Well, Rome, what happens when you take the training wheels off? You close your eyes when you're driving really fast, and you start to become intoxicated by your own power. That's Rome. But we learn, don't we? McNeese has done this for us. This is the part of you and me where we bend down to notice something that we have passed 1,000 times and not paid much attention. And we're noticing things at a scale that's making us in our boyish fashion scratch our head and think, I never saw that before. I never saw that before. And look, there's relationships going on. And there's more. That field is dead. And when you unleash the science on it, we find that there's microbes. Now we're finding these massive, the largest entities, living entities on Earth are these molds, these things that are growing, subterranean growth. And they're huge. So anybody that's telling us that things are what they seem to their eye, the untrained eye, I'm not too interested in that. Not here. If it's untrained and you're saying it's the eye of a baby, yeah, I'm curious what that untrained. Because you and I are aware of this language, this theory of mentalese. Children that understand things before they know things. McNeese was writing during this period, and I think it's interesting that he knelt down and was taking a look at the world around him. This is a fellow that was born in Belfast in 1907, just First World War material is when he was born. And he died on the 3rd of September in 1963 in London. Yeah. Today, I've selected something called Snow, this poem called Snow. Snow, it's one of his earlier poems, and it was first published in 1935. And it examines nothing less than the nature of existence itself. Well, no kidding. You've got this madness visiting the Earth, visiting the planet again. The cannon have just cooled off. The fields are being recontoured again into crops. The bodies are still being buried. There's still weaponry out in the fields that needs to be cleaned up. And yet here the madness, it wasn't, we're dealing with the big lie. It wasn't the war to end all war. How do we deal with this? What horror are we facing? So this fellow, Lewis, looks at the nature of existence. No kidding. Somebody ought to. Looking out a bay window, the poem's speaker is suddenly struck by the stark contrast between the white snow falling outside and some pink roses, presumably on the windowsill. And it's a sight that makes the speaker think about how vast and wildly diverse and mysterious the world is. You know? Like, really? Wouldn't you just think, here we go again? And I know some listeners today are thinking that. Here we go again. And yet they'll say that it was good men that prevailed, this need to conquer the madness. The speaker's in a room and it's filled with vibrance. Just the snow falls outside. You think of the metaphor. You can do this too. You can do this too. And you think, what? I see this snow falling, or I see rain falling. What else falls? Well, the stock exchange falls. Hopes come and go. My faith may fall if I'm seeing some tragedy and I can't accept the answer, like the futility of it all. The world is bigger and more bizarre than people think, the speaker says. And people fail to realize how stubbornly diverse it is. Yep. So I have to agree with some of this. But he brings this sense of urgency. He peels a tangerine and splits it into different segments, and then he spits out the seeds while eating it and feels giddy. He laughs. I don't know. Imagine that. From the knowledge that one thing can be all many things at once. And the fire is warm and bubbling. The world is both meaner and happier than people imagine. And people take it in through their senses of taste and sight and hearing and touch. The glass of the window isn't the only thing standing between the snow and the massive roses. So McNeice has said the mysterious snow is about the realization of a very obvious fact, and that one thing is different from another. Seeing the white snow pile up outside a window alongside the pink roses makes him think how surprising and diverse and contradictory the world can be. You see? The strangeness. So this guy is talking about the strangeness. You and I understand what strangeness is, and it's undeniable. There's also an excitement of living in a reality that's suddener, crazier, more various. It's as if this guy was writing yesterday. So in this little poem, I'm not going to draw this out. I'll get to it. It implies people don't tend to notice or appreciate how bizarre and various the world truly is. Amen to that, brother. Mm-hmm. Speaker talks about eating a tangerine before noting that even this specific fruit isn't actually a single unified object. It's filled with pips and seeds, and tangerines both whole and made up of little fragmented parts, and edible and inedible, you know, the peel. So he's looking at this little tangerine, and he's he feels sort of, what? The drunkenness of things being various. I'll leave you with that little. The drunkenness of things being various. What does he mean? We could talk about seeing reality subjective and incomplete, because the world is, in fact, with opposing entities that seem to impossibly yet inevitably coexist. Mm. The balance, eh? The room was suddenly rich, and the great bay window was spawning snow and pink roses against it, soundlessly collateral and incompatible. Soundlessly collateral and incompatible. World is suddener than we fancy it. World is crazier, and more of it than we think, incorrigibly plural. I peel and portion a tangerine and spit the pips and feel the drunkenness of things being various. And the fire flames with a bubbling sound, for world is more spiteful and gay than one supposes. On the tongue, on the eyes, on the ears, in the palms of one's hand, there is more than glass between the snow and the huge roses. It's happening again. Thank you. To say that we struggle to work together, I think is, it's challenged by listening to this kind of music, to listen to this jazz. This is Michel and Louis Petrucciani, sitting in with Lenny White. The music comes together. And this is a particular orchestration. So, metaphor, these things are happening around us all the time. I don't know if I would say it's you know, of course, to compare it with the vastness of what we're doing. Well, you know, it's like the quartet, again with this, 146 players with a conductor, and that just the respect of the diversity, the joy. This is a complicated instrument we're trying to perfect. Complicated, it's us. I want to. We're going to talk today about the history. Remember, we were talking about the period last week, and we're still looking at the influence of the of English, Scottish, and Irish Masonic growth on The Hague, in Holland, in the Netherlands, and yet their politic and their pressures were unique to that area. Unique. Similar but different, and we hear today we're looking at the bad boy in all of this, the Charlie Sheen of this, the James Dean, is this lodge, Le Bien Ami, and the historian here cites them as being rebellious, and of course we would they were rebellious toward their Grand Lodge, and this is, I think, a lesson for us, because remember. Everything, it's like everything that we do. If we take it out of context, it's simple to hack away and to judge and walk away feeling so powerful and right there. I've made my point. But real life does. Is there anything about your life that stands still so that you can examine it like that? Anything that stands still. If there is, please. Get in contact with me, because I've yet to find it. Everything is, there's a dynamic, there's a rhythm, a vibration to everything. So everything is like that. Everything. Even, and I'm adherent to string theory, even that energy, little strings, strings of energy and relationships. Here, we're looking straight down the barrel of the relationship. Is this Le Bien Ami going to be an influence, a rebelliousness? And this is toward a Grand Lodge, and it came from it's impossible to separate what the lodge is doing from the disfavor of Rousset de Messy. He was, the poster boy of masonry, and then not even close. He has to go. 1749, he has to go. And there was a fear of radicalism that he represented, and a few of his brothers became attracted to that, as you can imagine. Here we're gonna burn an effigy of Hiram, and that's gonna cleanse us. You know, it's gonna prove we're manly, we're braver, we're more profound. Yeah. But clearly there were still men in the new lodges, at the very least, who constitute a private governance for themselves. We do that today. Yes, you can transcend. The Constitution and the symbiosis between the moral authority and our constitutional authority, we live with that. We live that symbiosis. And then many of us, become quite comfortable. That's not a burden or a distraction. It certainly doesn't interrupt the creativity and imagination that we require to go about our business of absorbing all of these outrageously enlightening ideas and then applying them. My goodness, don't just think it. Apply it. You think you care about people? Create a beautiful garden so when people walk past, they smile. Create some beauty in the world because, oh my goodness, the world is a tragedy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Create something beautiful. Shakespeare took up the task, didn't he? 15th century kind of guy. Verdi did it with music. Bach did it. Beethoven did it. Haydn did it. You create beauty. How much beauty? Well, how about you create beauty here? You create beauty that is not only in the moment, but is enduring. Do I want you to write the next symphony or the next opera? Yeah. Or encourage those who have that kind of skill and drive and need. Yeah. Or the poet to be courageous enough to describe things that we skirt past every day. Here, do I want the perfect inclination, the freedom? Yes. And I want the judgment. It doesn't come, the balance. I want that inclination, but I want the ethical balance as well. I want the ethical force to know, what do I do with that? Do I just start carrying on and being influenced? Well, I can. If I'm going to move forward as a Freemason without any ethical or moral rudder underneath me, that's, gentlemen, ladies, that's just not acceptable. But at the time, this is about legitimacy as well, isn't it? And yes, expect and demand of myself the same rigor that is written about by our historians, by our history. It's hard, but it's good. They were capable of seeking for themselves and defying authority within the context of a fraternal organization dedicated to constitutional order and obedience to legitimate authority. That, I think, is essential. Other lodges were also capable of rebelling against the decisions of Grand Lodge, returning their constitution, and seeking a new one from London. Serious stuff. We can do the same thing. Here, send it back. Take it. You know, you don't stop this concourse. You don't stop the conversation. But at the same token, when the Grand Lodge acted intentionally, it concluded a treaty of alliance with Prussia in 1778 in the general interest of the two nations and traveling brothers in particular, the safety. Freemasons imitated as well as defied political authority with remarkable self-confidence. In this, we need to speculate on what may have been one of the intellectual sources for the defiant mode. We can examine this. History allows us to stop time. We know that it's artificial. It doesn't stop, huh? But it's that archetype that we need to, it's the stereotype, so that we can begin to understand what in the hell is going on. But also, given that it all moves forward, we will at least learn that some of the Dutch brothers knew the political writings of the English philosopher John Locke. Ah, he seemed to prescribe the true principles around which a nation's government could best be organized. In the last decades of the 18th century, continental Freemasons of a variety of ideological persuasions idealized the lodges as places where true patriotism and love of country could be expressed. The discovery that what was true in the lodges of the Dutch Republic could be true in other parts of Europe only reinforces the point about the lodges being philosophical societies for the mercantile and genteel, where within small and intimate settings, all sorts of civic ideas could find expression. Why? Because it's intimate. What we're describing here is the personal nature of Masonry, eh? corporate, not authority. It's authority with a point, with purpose. Complex? Yeah. Well, that certainly was an interesting show. We step by step. We don't get into this kind of a conversation with one great big leap. It's step by step. You work on this. You strengthen the mind as much as we can handle at the time. Not too much. It's like I wouldn't have this kind of a conversation with a group of entered apprentices. That would not be, I think, appropriate. They have other skills that they need to learn that befit their level of ability, and they need time with the material, time to digest and observe. And what will they see? Well, they'll see subjectively, they'll see the difference between what we do and what we say. Now, we need to be able to, at some point, have a reasonable and intelligent response for them, because it's not their secret that they're seeing it. It is our exposure. We expose ourselves each and every day to these ideals that are in contrast with our flawed nature. Anyway, let me sign off. I hope you'll come back. Whether next week we're looking at the program on perfect inclinations or eyes wide open, talking about the legitimacy in our efforts to work with our legacy. And remember, if you go about, as I always say, commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. But remember, anyone can do it when everything is calm. But we do it. It's not calm. Everything's moving and we make it look easy. Yeah. See you soon. Thanks for tuning in. Mm-hmm.